Talk Show.
Recorded live.
Hi, welcome back to Masonic Central. This is our 11th episode on September 21st of 2008. This is the podcast show for Freemasons by Freemasons, hosted weekly to explore the depths of the Masonic world. If you're on the web, you can visit us at www.masoniccentral.com or send us an email at masoniccentral@gmail.com. My name is Greg Stewart, and this is my fellow host, Dean Kennedy. And we are here live this week. Just a couple of quick things to touch on from past shows. I just wanted to make a mention how to participate in the show for anybody who's new coming on or listening to this. You can listen to us live on the web if you're listening to us as a download podcast. If you are listening to us live on the web, I just want to reiterate that this is a non-biased, non-agenda, non-recruitment show. And if you have any questions that you want to bring to us, hold them to the end or key them into our online forum, which you can log into off of TalkShoe, and we'll get to them as the show progresses. This is not, I just want to make a note here, unless otherwise stated, an open forum for discussion. So, Dean, I hear you've got a little bit of news that you want to bring to us this week? A couple of things
to mention? Yeah, our newest segment of the show is to give a bit of news every week about what's going on in the Masonic world. And the biggest item this week would be the recognition of North Carolina Grand Lodge recognizing the Prince Hall Grand Lodge in North Carolina. So that has made the headlines, and as well, a little footnote here is that one of our fellow listeners and bloggers, Fred Milliken, was appointed a lecturer in his district as well, and I wanted to point that out for anyone that reads the Beehive. We have him on our website, masoniccentral.com. You can link right to his website there and check him out, and he's been away for a little bit, and we welcome him back from he's had the illness.
Yeah, absolutely. Good to have you back there, Fred. This week, everybody, I'd like to introduce and bring to our forum Nelson King. How are you doing tonight, Nelson?
Well, I'm here, and before I start, I'd like to really congratulate you guys because, you know, they say that Freemasonry doesn't evolve very quickly, but you guys have made it evolve rapidly and into an iPod broadcast and all that sort of thing, and you are to be congratulated.
Thank you.
Oh, well, thank you very much. I just to mention a little bit in that segue there, Nelson King is a present editor and past president of the Philaces Society. And for those that don't know the Philaces Society, we'll talk about it a little bit tonight, but it is one of the preeminent and oldest Masonic research societies.
We are getting a correction on my announcement for Fred. It's the lecturer for the Dallas chapter of the Philalexis Society. So I made a mistake, and actually that's even probably a bigger honor. So congratulations, Fred Milliken, on your appointment.
But my organization is the Philalaces Society. It's a good Greek word meaning lover of truth, seeker of truth.
I have to tell you, Nelson, it doesn't matter how many times I've heard it or tried to say it, I butcher it every time, so I apologize about that. But perhaps, for the audience, maybe you could tell us a little bit about who Nelson King is. I know you have a pretty in-depth biography on the website that it's hosted off of, which is Freemason.org.
Right.
And for anybody who's interested, they can go to Freemason.org to read it. But who is Nelson King?
Nelson King is a 63-year-old, I was going to say a fat old man with a beard, but I shaved it off. Been around the Philalaces Society for, well, this is my 17th or 18th year as editor. I was initiated, passed, and raised in Toronto. I am a member of probably about 17 Grand Lodges. And that's about it. There's more stuff to read than you ever want to know on the website.
Just in going through the website and looking at that, you know, I was even thinking maybe I could mention some of it, but there was just so many different societies or organizations that you belong to or are part of that I almost want to say it's overwhelming. It's quite a list. You've been around the block quite a bit. You've had a finger in the Masonic world for some time.
Yes, I have.
That's probably putting it mildly. So tell us a little bit then, I guess, as an editor, and even about the society itself. There's a couple of topics that we want to get to tonight, but tell us about the society. I know it's been around since 1923, if I'm not mistaken.
It was established in 1923 by a bunch of Masons, scholars, that were a little sick and tired, to put it lightly, of being censored by their Grand Lodge and what they could write and what they couldn't write. And when you look at the list of the first 40 fellows, there's one name that will stand out to everybody, and that is, obviously, Rudyard Kipling. And Kipling was one of our first 40 fellows. And, you know, they've been all strong Masons ever since. And it's, you really... Things are changing so rapidly in Freemasonry that you really have to take a look now and see what is going on worldwide. And our mission is to basically bring news to the Masonic world as well as research articles and to bring the problems that are facing Freemasonry to the forefront and letting you know about the problems, such as the latest problem, as you're probably well aware, is the problem with the jesters.
Oh yeah, we've kind of banded that around in the blogosphere quite a bit, and even in here we talked a little bit about it. And even as we get along, we can probably touch back on it, though I don't necessarily want to focus on that. I know that it is definitely something, though, of a lot of interest to a lot of brothers. But as a research society, even going back then, 1923, you know, we like to think that our problems are unique today. Would you say that their situations were similar back then?
Publishing a magazine, actually, until I think it was 1946, if I'm not mistaken, off the top of my head. And it's rather funny to realize that with the recognition now of Prince Hall, that in 1947, the Philalethes magazine published the first article stating that Prince Hall affiliates were regular and would have to be recognized. And that was 1946. 1947. I was 2 years old at the time.
And how was that received? At the point that was put out, was that really crossing the line as to...
Oh, was it ever. I think you can imagine what happened when that was printed, and that's
absolutely.
When I guess we really started to get into looking for things like that which should be brought to the attention of the Masonic world.
You know, I agree with that. I think that's one of the unique things about the net today is that it allows a greater interconnectedness, obviously, what the net portrays in the web that it has, and in allowing people to talk about it. Back then, I mean, it was really just a published periodical.
That's all.
It would come out and allow them to just read, really, and not really interact. Just so I can correct myself, just on a couple instances here, it was 1928, the founding, and the website for... the Philalethes is freemasonry.org, so
Y-R-Y-A-N.org.
So with the publication then, and even the research, was there a focus to it, or was it a broad spectrum approach to just research in general?
It was to research in general and also researching the problems. We are not a quota coronati. We never said that we were a quota coronati. And the difference between a Masonic Research Society, which we are, and a Research Lodge, is that we have no ties to any Grand Lodge. Therefore, we are not constricted by the rules and regulations of that Grand Lodge.
Has there ever been a challenge to that? Have any Grand Lodges ever stepped up to question that ability? Or has it always just kind of been a pass?
In the last few years, Texas tried, and it was really great because when they tried, our membership in Texas increased 300%.
Almost the whole aspect of free advertising. That's interesting. You know, and I guess then there's not much as an organization. I mean, there really isn't. It's just the body itself that it answers to, the membership and the readers. And is it all member contributions? Do they contribute into?
We will publish anything written by I was going to say, written by anybody. Yeah, yeah, we will. We'll take a look. You submit an article, and we do not care whether you're a member of the society or not. But the article is worthwhile, and it has interest to our membership. We will print it.
Interesting. Very interesting.
What a bunch. Excuse me.
How many research societies would you say exist presently in the United States? I know it's a little bit spectrum off topic.
I honestly don't know. I know there's a new one out now, and there's ourselves, but the new one that has just come out, they are basically looking at memberships within the Conference of Grand Masters of North America.
I think we've seen that one. Yep, and that one's coming up. I, you know, even in the blog post that I mentioned, it seemed that of the people that responded, each one had their own local research lodge that came up. And hello.
Let's go.
Somebody's chiming in there. See if you can find out who that is, Dean. With research lodges, it seemed like everybody was contributing their own research lodges within their state. I know even here in Southern California, they've got one of the preeminent ones is the Southern California Research Lodge. And even as a Mason now 11 years on, it's been difficult, I guess, at best to really find these research lodges. You know, oftentimes it's word of mouth, somebody mentioning it and someone else that you know is a part of it. I wonder, do research lodges really solicit membership? Do they announce their presence, or is it?
Well, I know the Research Lodge in Ontario does. That's the Heritage Lodge. They're at Grand Lodge. They hold a booth at Grand Lodge and all that sort of stuff. But then again, a Research Lodge, as I say, is completely different from the society because of the facts. Well, let's look at Quattro Coronati, for example. The lodge itself meets four times a year. Now, if they were going to have a guest speaker, say, from the Droit Humain, they could not have one in open lodge because of the fact that they are not recognized by the United Grand Lodge of England. Whereas us, a research society holding no ties to any Grand Lodge, we would not have a problem having that person speak.
So it's a definite separation then. I think I understand that then. That's interesting. Have you found people to flock to both, or are they? And again, just to even focusing on the aspect of the society versus other research lodges, do people tend to go both, or do they choose one over the other?
I'm curious, in your
experience.
Because most Grand Lodges will not reveal their membership list, and neither will the Phil Lathys. All I can tell you is that we're still growing.
That's a very good thing. That's a very good thing. With this aspect, and so from 28 to now, and the growth rate we've seen, as an editor, I surmise that you have a pretty good bird's eye view of what the future holds. How do you see it growing in the next 100 years? Any ideas as to what it will evolve into?
Freemasonry in North America is different than Freemasonry in the rest of the world. And I'm going to say, Freemasonry in North America, I think you're going to see it going to have to go back to the future type of thing, going back to traditional observant type lodges, because the young people coming in today know much more about Freemasonry than I ever did when I first joined. And I think that is our future. That's my own personal opinion. Our future is not your father or your grandfather's Freemasonry, but your great-great-great-great-grandfather's Freemasonry.
Seems to be going back quite a ways. I'm curious if you've tracked or seen where some of those ideas are coming from as to how people are even able to go back that far to bring it forward. You know, I've had conversations with folks even in this last week talking about it and just the idea of we're trying to relearn the way to learn.
Yeah,
we're trying to go back and try to bring something forward that you know, we at this point today, we're not even quite clear of exactly what it was.
Well, you see, the first couple of articles that I remember, one was written by, off the top of my head, from Australia. You know, Tony Henderson, I think it was Tony Henderson, Tony Pope or Henderson wrote it. And it was on a lodge called Epicurean Lodge. And then I wrote an article called Back to the Future, and then people started to jump on the bandwagon. And now you're finding these traditional observant lodges are springing up all over the place. And they are it's quite different. Even the way you join is different, especially when you get outside of North America. Like, for example, if you're going to join in Costa Rica, you will provide the Grand Secretary with a color photo, your curriculum vitae, a written and signed police report, and a credit bureau report.
Wow. Wow.
The Grand Secretary will make up a card about the size of a number 10 envelope with your picture and your CV on it. It is posted in every lodge building in Costa Rica. It sits there for 1 year, and if nobody takes it down, an investigation committee is formed, and that normally takes about a year. So
wow.
It's 2 years, and you're well vetted then before you come in. But not only that, the little Grand Lodge down there teaches a course on Freemasonry at the local university.
They take it as serious business, then. You know, I hate to say it, but they take it more serious than America.
Latin America, if you are, and again, in Cuba too, if you are ostracized by your lodge or your Grand Lodge, you're pretty well ostracized by the whole community. And see, that's the way it used to be years and years and years and decades ago in North America. And somehow we sort of evolved into a service club.
It's that's an interesting aspect of it. I've had conversations with Tom Jackson, and that seems to be quite the theme that comes up with it, and what American Masonry is. But even just to focus a little bit more on South American Masonry, which actually will lead into something that we want to get into in a little bit about Cuba. I know I've heard these tales of South American Masonry, and even going into the Scottish Rite, that it takes literally a year to progress degrees, so that there is this broader sense of importance to it, and that it's not just something to get through quickly.
Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, I was going to ask, have you had an opportunity to survey other countries, South American countries like that, to see if that's something that's consistent across the board, or is it something unique to Costa Rica?
It's consistent across the board, and you'll find that most of the Grand Lodges in Latin America are growing at a rate of about 10% a year, and always have been and always will be. Should never say always will be, should I? They are growing.
That's amazing to me.
Yeah.
What is it you think, any ideas as to what it is that they take different in it? Is it just a cultural difference in how they approach it, or is it because it came later?
And it is something that means something. It doesn't, when you go to a meeting, it doesn't mean that you're going to go in there and for 45 minutes listen to how many bills that we should pay and then go out for a stale donut and a coffee. They have very heavy discussions about Freemasonry. For example, an entered apprentice will be asked to produce a paper on what it meant to him going through as an entered apprentice. And he'll talk about things like the chamber of reflection that they all go through and all this sort of stuff. And the papers are basically not criticized. Sometimes the scholarly papers are criticized, but an entered apprentice, he's led and guided, and then, in a year's time, he becomes a fellow craft, or in some cases, 2 years' time.
Hmm. Do you think that that's something that originated here, or is that something unique in their formation?
Unique in Europe and in Latin America. Other than the English-speaking world, let's say it is the norm in the non-English-speaking world.
Outside of here. Interesting. As I know, a lot of what the TOs, traditional observance lodges, for those who don't know, a lot of their emphasis is on that. And even in a regular lodge setting, I could attest into my lodge, we've started that where as individuals go through the degrees, there's a request, not a requirement, of course, because it falls under each lodge's, Grand Lodge's discretion, but a request to approach a paper like that, to actually produce something and contribute to the overall good. I'm curious, as part of the society, if you've heard that before, or if that seems to be something that's growing, or if that's just a unique thing that's happening with the TOs now.
Yeah, it's something that is growing and something that basically, I guess, we've been talking about for, 20 years now. And it's slowly starting to evolve. I think lodges have. I personally believe that there are too many members and not enough Masons in Freemasonry in North America. That's my personal opinion.
That's an interesting point. How do you quantify that?
How
would you define that?
Okay, put it this way. I'll tell you, there's not a Mason in Costa Rica that I would not trust with my life savings.
I can't say that about my mother lodge
here in Ontario.
Wow, just with the degree of severity that they take it. Do you think, though, that it's incumbent upon us to assume that of ourselves before we go into looking at others like that, or do you think that it's just a disconnect, perhaps, in just the teachings itself?
I think in Latin America, it's a way of life because everything is a matter of honor. You know, I always tell a little story about Miguel Pejez when he was the Grand Secretary of Costa Rica. He's no longer with us, unfortunately. But they had a fellow, excuse me for a sec, they had a fellow come in from Mexico who had had his wallet stolen and he needed $250 to go home. And they proved him a Mason and they recognized him and all that, so they gave him the $250. And he promised he'd pay it back. Well, you know, 8-9 weeks goes by and no money. So Miguel says in his broken English, I got mad. I wrote as a Grand Master. Well, about 3 weeks later, there's a phone call in the Grand Lodge building, and the voice says, Brother Pejez, my name is so-and-so. I'm the Grand Master of such-and-such Grand Lodge in Mexico. I will be flying into San Jose, Costa Rica tomorrow to return your $250.
Wow.
Miguel says, you don't have to do that. You just send me a check. He says, Brother Pejez, shame on you. You know I have to do it. It's a matter of honor.
Wow. Wow.
You know another Grand Master in North America that would fly, you know, that distance to return a lousy $250?
It's definitely a role of honor. That's
Yeah.
That's interesting. So with that in mind, then, so as this has developed in South America differently than America, and part of our topics tonight was to look at Freemasonry in Cuba.
Mm-hmm.
And so do you think that these aspects that have evolved in South American Masonry are true also of Freemasonry in Cuba?
Most definitely. There are 30,000 Freemasons in Cuba. They practice the Scottish Rite. They are well known and they are well respected by the population of Cuba because for us Canadians that go down there who've ever been to any place in Cuba, and if you're wearing a Masonic ring, you will be approached by someone who says, either my father's a Mason or I'm a Mason. And for people who have nothing, they will treat you like royalty. And
wow,
I do mean they have enough, because the average Cuban makes $25 a month. And out of that, you know, life has to go on.
It's an amazing testimonial to it. I'm a little bit shocked, though, that Masonry has been allowed to exist in Cuba with Castro. Even as a qualifier a little bit, you know, American Masons may not be that familiar with Freemasonry in Cuba. And I'm curious how you have gotten so knowledgeable about it and involved in it. I know there's quite a bit of information on your site that talks about it and even just your activities with the Cuban Masonic Relief, which is in part what we want to talk about. How has Freemasonry in Cuba survived, frankly?
Okay, first of all, I have two stories to tell you. One I can prove and one is a rumor. The rumor is that during the so-called revolution, the Masons around Santiago de Cuba hid Castro and his men from Batista in the Sierra Maestre Mountains. That's a rumor. I can't prove that. What I can prove is after the revolution was over, Castro called the Grand Secretary and the Grand Master in to where he was and basically asked them if they discussed Freemasonry, if they discussed politics in their lodges. They said no, it was forbidden, and he's basically just left them alone. He hasn't done anything for them. He's just left them alone.
Wow. This is Dean here. I just want to ask a question to Ian Nelson and maybe along the Cuba line. There is a rumor that people keep trying to prove in the fact that they think that Fidel is a Mason. Do you know anything about that?
Yeah, he's definitely not.
I was just curious. There's always that rumor flowing around, you know?
I got like that one from the Grand Secretary, who is one of my dearest friends now down there. He is not a Mason.
It's like the rumor of Napoleon. Go ahead.
And another thing I wanted to ask was...
It's like the rumor that's going around now that Obama is a Mason.
Yeah, in America. That's true. Go ahead, Dean. What was your other question?
I was just going to ask another big question I had is, it's not really a question, it's most of the Grand Lodges, do they not operate in government buildings, or they own the buildings and the government runs stuff through their buildings during the day?
Okay, the government owns everything. Okay,
yep.
They've allowed them the use of their buildings. The temple in Havana is absolutely gorgeous. There is nothing in there but Freemasonry. And that's the major, that's the Grand Lodge. If you hear some strange noises, it's because my cat just jumped up on the table.
Oh, is your cat a Mason?
No, he is not. This was a stray that we found that decided he wanted to live here, and he's a pain in the you-know-what.
Okay, well, he's not allowed in on the show, I'm sorry. No, just joking.
You'd be surprised.
So with the buildings that are in Cuba, then if it all belongs to the government and the government just gives a pass to it, is there a disconnect to the government?
Right, they took over all the homes, and if you were living in a house, you still got to continue to live in that house.
Right. But with Masonry, though, I'm curious to the if you've ever come across it. Has the government there ever really looked into the history of it with the French Revolution, American Revolution, and the prominent Masons that were part of it? Or has it just been a fact that they weren't necessarily a threat necessarily that they?
I honestly cannot answer that. I don't know. I know that the Freemasonry in Cuba is 149 years old.
Yep.
And just a second here, I got the cats making a mess here. And one of the Cubans' best known Masons, the guy is a fellow by the name of Jose Marta, who is a Cuban hero. And wrote one of the songs he wrote was Juan Tanamera. If you heard the song, you'd know it. But
sing it for us at all, Nelson?
Right.
Oh no.
No, he is. If you look up Marta, he was a revolutionary back getting Spain out of Cuba, and he is one of their Cuban people's greatest heroes, and also a Freemason. So it's been ingrained in the country for 149 years.
Wow. I'm fascinated by the fact that Freemasonry has been allowed to thrive in Cuba. So, you know, even if you look at some of the American stance back 30, 40 years ago at communism and, you know, the ethos that, you know, a communist cannot be a Freemason because of the issues of atheism and whatnot, that it was still allowed to exist there, that it was still allowed to exist and thrive. And so, again, you have an interesting perspective on it because you are not in the States. You are in Canada,
right.
As we talked about early in the beginning of the call. So you do have some connections there to really talk about the community and work with them in some ways.
Yeah, I started Masonic Relief for Cuba about 10 years ago. My wife and I went to a trip in Cuba. We went to Santiago de Cuba, and a young lady said, "Oh, you're a Mason. My father is the president of his lodge." And that was my dear friend now, Luciano de Mayo. And we started talking, and I was in basically a tuck shop. And I noticed that they had aspirin for sale, and the aspirins were 4 aspirins for $10 American.
Wow. Wow.
And when you make $25 a month, you're not going to spend $4 on aspirin. Then I ran into another brother whose wife had been in and out of the hospital with a simple yeast infection for 9 months. Something your ladies will go down and spend $14.95 and it's cured. So I guess now we've sent now approximately 5,000 pounds of medical supplies through this little charity to Cuba. If I get a prescription that I need to be filled, I cannot get it filled in Ontario because our doctors have to see the patient before they write the script. But what happens is my brothers who are medical doctors in Costa Rica, I send them the prescription, they fill it, and mail it to Cuba. They've been also making me eyeglasses when I get special requests for certain prescriptions for eyeglasses. And how good these guys are down there is that I asked them what the cost would be, and the fellow said it would be $50 a pair. I said, fine, no problem. I sent his grandfather, who I knew quite well, $500. And to date, I probably have had 25 pairs of glasses made, and to date, I have $500 plus interest still in the account down there because they pick up the cost.
Wow. It's an amazing story to even think about. You know, again, coming from an American perspective, because it is so disconnected. I surmise you travel down there frequently. How often do you...
I haven't been down for a while. I'm going down again in 2009. And as a matter of fact, I'm off to Ottawa on Wednesday to pick up colostomy bags. Because what they've been using down there, because most of the people can't afford them, or most of the masons can't afford them, they've been using grocery bags, your plastic grocery bag just taped to your side.
Wow.
Yeah, we don't know how lucky we are. We really don't.
We lose sight. Go ahead, Dean.
Greg, I was just going to pump in and say that Grayson has a question for Nelson that he wanted to ask about Cuba and masonry. Grayson,
Grayson, please.
Yeah, I'm here. It's not so much a question. I'm just very interested in Cuban masonry because South Carolina, where I'm from, was very instrumental in founding masonry down there, or helping it become a Grand Lodge. That is. I find this an interesting subject. In fact, I'm right now in front of me. I'm looking at the Mackey's History of Freemasonry in South Carolina, where it talks about Cuba, and it talks about founding lodges down there, South Carolina founding lodges down there to form a Grand Lodge. So I kind of hold a little special place in my heart, I guess you could say, concerning Cuba.
Well, you know that if I'm not mistaken, most American Grand Lodges recognize the Grand Lodge of Cuba. As a matter of fact, we up here in Canada were hit very hard by something called the Helms-Burton Act, which was from Jesse Helms, who the senator from the great state of North Carolina. And I happened to be at Grand Lodge in North Carolina, and one of their fellows had been going down there and taking stuff down there with his church group. And he wanted to get a Bible for their altar because the old one they had was just, you know, it was basically a paperback. It was falling apart because, you know, in 50 years you don't get that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
And the Grand Lodge says, fine, we'll donate one. Then all of a sudden the Grand Lodge realized that they had not re-recognized Cuba. And while I was there, they recognized Cuba and gave the Bible to the fellow to take down there. So that was rather interesting.
That's amazing. I was reading through, just looking at that New York Times article. With the prominence that it has, with the 30,000 members, is there much of a government infiltration to it? I'm curious if you ever hear stories like that. Is there really a concern for that, or is it not?
I don't think there's any concern amongst the Cuban people for that, and I've never run into any. So, you know, it's kind of hard to tell. How do you tell who's a government infiltrator and who's not?
Who's the spook and who's not?
You did touch on early on upon the secret, really, and the fact that in the rumor you said about Fidel Castro being sheltered by the Masons, that he asked if they discussed politics in their lodge, and they said no, and therefore he was happy with Masonry as long as they don't discuss politics. So I think that answers a lot of questions, actually, as to why he would tolerate them.
It also tells you a lot about the man Castro, doesn't it?
Yes.
You know, he's not the boogeyman that he's been made out to be. I don't believe in his politics, but I think he's probably one of the most interesting men in the world that is still alive today.
So
I'd like to be able to interview would be like people like Churchill, because my father was an Englishman. Castro has to be in there as well. You know, there's a whole list of people that if you could only go back in time and talk to them.
Actually get a chance to spend some time and ask them, absolutely. It's so odd hearing this because in the States, so often it's demonized as, you know, this communist country that's just, you know, hurting its people and not helping them.
You know,
it's interesting to hear this perspective.
Most people in Cuba love them. Whether they've been brainwashed or what, I don't know, but they do love them. By the way, one of my stories I love to tell is about JFK, John Fitzgerald Kennedy, who did sign the embargo against Cuba. 3 days before the embargo was to be signed, he sent two interns down to Cuba to buy up all the cigars that he liked and bring them back to the White House. And once they were safe in the White House, he signed the embargo against Cuba.
Covering all of his bases, making sure he's covered. We actually, from our gallery, we have a question that was asked: is if Raul Castro is changing the way that he's dealing with the Masons, or if it's staying status quo? Have you heard of any changes coming down the pipeline now?
Unfortunately, a lot of their buildings, because there is no paint available and no building supplies that are available without extreme heavy costs, a lot of the old buildings are really starting to fall into disrepair, and some of them were the most gorgeous buildings in the world, but I think the status quo is going to remain for a while. You know, you're there, we leave you alone. But again, that's my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
God, if I could read minds, I'd be a millionaire.
I know. Well, you know, I think in so many ways, because of your affiliation with it and because of your proximity and talking to folks and your ability to turn that around and project it to the rest of us as, you know, website updates or anything else, you're a great source to go to. Go ahead.
It's unfortunate that this Masonic Relief for Cuba, many years ago, I wrote to your Treasury Department and asked if Masons in the United States could make contributions to help cover the cost of postage to sending these things down there. And about 9 weeks after I wrote the letter, I got a phone call from a young lady in the Treasury Department and said, no, they couldn't do that because it would be breaking statute such and such and such and such. So I asked her to put it in writing, and she refused.
Nobody wanted a cop to it, I see.
So,
Did you ever get anything in writing for it?
No, never. No, all I got was one phone call. Now, I do get some donations from the United States. I get a lot of donations from Canada, obviously, because Canadians go down there and they know what the problem is. As a matter of fact, one of the deputy grand masters of one of our grand lodges up here last week went to his druggist and told him about the problem with colostomy bags because I needed some in a real hurry. And the druggist said, look, I know all the problems. I was just in Cuba, again, being Canadian. And he gave him every colostomy bag that he had in the in his drugstore.
I have a question here. Obviously, it's Dean here again. I'm the only guy that pipes in all the time. Canadian Mason went down to Cuba, what's the best way to make, are we allowed to get into the lodges, to sit in the lodge, and or if Americans find a way in there somehow?
Seriously, if you go, normally Canadians just go to the resorts.
Yeah, unless you're my father, who goes to the villages.
If you're father, you're walking around, you're banging on doors then to get into places. But if you're in a resort, somebody will recognize you as from your ring, tell them you want to go to the lodge, and they will take you to the lodge. They will look after you like you wouldn't believe. And for people with nothing to look after us is something.
That's a remarkable testament, absolutely.
And for those writing, talking about cigars, if you go to Key West, it's the closest thing to Cuban cigars you'll get if you're an American stuck in the United States and can't get to Cuba.
I'd say I've had one in my lifetime, but they're definitely hard to come by on cheap. You know, I'm curious, Nelson, and I'm curious with your experiences too.
Come to Toronto.
We had a guy typing in about cigars, so I had to answer his question.
Come to Toronto. Go to 606 King Street West. That's Frank Coretti's Cigars. That company has the only license in the world to import Cuban tobacco and has been hand-rolling Cuban cigars in Toronto for five generations And when they package them, they put them into the tin can with a Canadian excise stamp on them.
Making them legal in the United States. Very, very clever. Is he a member of Lodge?
No.
Oh, okay. We'll have to work on him.
That's funny. I'm curious, and this is into the aspect of Cuban masonry. I've heard from brothers who are from South American countries, and the disparity between the Catholic Church and Freemasonry, and how in some places it really is like islands. You know, you have this island of masonry and this Catholicism around it, competing with it, or even disagreeing with it in violence at some point. Does Cuba see that at all, or is it really kept the two separate? Do regular Cuban citizens?
There's nothing between the two of them. And I'm very surprised at that about the Catholic Church, because in Latin America, 98% of the population are Roman Catholics. Therefore, you must assume that 90% of the members of the lodges are Roman Catholics. Now, if you ever get to go to San Jose, Costa Rica, make an appointment, go in and see the museum. The centerpiece of the museum is the Roman Catholic Bishop of Arch of Costa Rica's mitre. On the front of it, in pearls and jewels and gold and all that sort of stuff, is the 18th degree Rose Croix. when the lining is pulled out, there you will find Bishop Thiel's initials embroidered into the lining along with the square and compasses. His mitre was given to him by his brothers in Costa Rica when he became Bishop of Costa Rica.
Wow. I think that's what's so unique and so interesting about masonry as it's developed in South America and south of the United States, really. And it seems like it's like that across the continent from Mexico on down south.
Yeah.
Another topic that we don't know much about that we may explore down the road. I think that would be an exciting thing to do. So with this, just to go back to Cuba, then in particular with your activities to it, with the Cuban Relief, you mentioned briefly about collecting some funds from south of the border in America and sending there. Is Cuban Relief, are you finding a strong interest in that in Canadian masonry or just in Canada in general?
I am now, because of the fact that the two hurricanes devastated the whole island. But, as I said, we've been doing this for 10 years, and in 10 years, I think we sent down over 5,000 pounds worth of stuff. And you got to realize, because of the laws, I can only send down 2-kilo parcels. 2 kilos is 4.4, maybe almost close to 5 pounds, without getting special permission from the Cuban embassy. So we do the things in small parcels so we can sort of fly underneath the radar, even though I did write to Castro and asked for his permission to do so.
Has he responded yet?
I got a letter from one of his ministers, who happened to be one of his cousins, and said yes, we could do it, but they would rather we did it through the government, and I didn't want to do it through the government.
Go through official channels. That's interesting. I'm fascinated by it. Even hearing the old stories of America and their ability to go to Cuba and not having that option now, it's always sounded like a wonderful country to go to.
There used to be a train,
was there not? A train from Key West to Cuba? Wasn't there a train being built to go to Cuba?
No.
Oh, no, that's 90 miles over water. Yeah. Good luck. So a lot of Americans go to Cuba, they go out of Jamaica or they go out of Mexico.
There was never a train.
Just checking if you're listening.
I will not tell you that the Cubans do not stamp American passports.
Oh, no official visitations that way.
That's right.
That's interesting. Go ahead.
Oh, Greg, I was going to ask Nelson, another thing that's coming up, we talked a little bit before the show, but the Grand Lodge in Exile of Cuba, can you talk a little bit about that? Perhaps a couple of the listeners were asking some questions about that.
Oh, very little bit. I have a friend who's a member, but again, I know very little about them. Again,
so do any lodges in Canada recognize that lodge?
No.
No, okay. Does the Cuban Grand Lodge recognize it?
I do know that the Grand Lodge of Cuba in Exile has been in touch since the hurricane with the Grand Secretary in Cuba and has offered assistance. So we'll see what happens from there.
Okay.
Also, the District Grand Lodge of Jamaica, English Constitution, first time in history, met with the Cuban Grand Master and Grand Secretary, came to one of their meetings. And so, you know, the world is getting smaller and smaller and smaller.
It would seem so at every step. And that was actually going to be my question. Do you foresee, perhaps, as the policies start to change, that Masonry may have a more influential role there? Or do you think that they'll continue on with the
I think Freemasonry has a role
government?
There now. Even though it is an unofficial role, it has a large role in Cuba.
Do you think it'll change as the government edges closer and closer to transition? Or do you think that they'll just continue to passively be by and... As an organization, obviously as individuals contributing, but as a group, do you think that they'll have any influence?
Well, you know, you got 30,000 voters.
I know it seems like such a degree of solidarity in it that it would be a force to be reckoned with.
Well, you see, my idea.
And I'm sure it's.
I'm sorry, my idea of Masonic charity has never been. Charity to strangers. My personal philosophy on Masonic charity is to other Masons. And, you know, I think we have to look after our own, and after we've looked after our own, then we can look after others. But that's just my personal opinion.
Absolutely. No, I tend to agree with that, and I'm sure most of our listeners do. I mean, that seems to be a common theme that we pick up on and talk about in Masonry and delve into. And I think one of the causal effects of that, though, is that it does roll down to outside of Masonry. You know, as helping the families of Masonry, it helps the communities that they exist in, you know, as you're trying to bring an assistance to everyone. Something I want to mention, and you talked about briefly, was that next year they are celebrating their 150th year.
Yep.
And we talked about it just before the call. Are you mentioned something to the effect that you're going to be there a part of it?
Well, I've been invited to go down and be a speaker.
Very nice. Any thoughts as to what you may speak about to them, or is it just a
Oh, first of all, I'll let you know later.
All this time you haven't picked up the language yet?
I have. There's only two phrases in Spanish you need to know. And the first is "una cerveza, por favor," which is "can I have a please?"
Yes, sir. One more.
And the other phrase you have to learn is "dónde es los baños?" Where's the bathroom?
and thus your evening is complete. Hey, you have both your primary needs.
I basically speak something called Spanglish.
A little bit of mixing between the two. All right, with their big celebration, are they ramping up? Is it going to be a big to-do in the country, or is it something that they're more
well,
subtle
already,
and more low-key?
They've already started to send out invitations, so I think it's going to be something fairly big in the Masonic community and even the Masonic community outside of Cuba. It may, and again, I understand that, you know, the Grand Lodge of D.C. goes down there every year.
Are they doing that with the national dispensation? How are they?
They get the permission from the Treasury Board.
Interesting. Very interesting. That's
you got to get into this, dude.
I think I do, actually.
It's a long way to go from Florida to D.C. to go to a meeting.
I can imagine, but it'd be worth it, I think. One of the things that just in doing a little bit of research for it too is the Cuban Symposium on Freemasonry that, if I'm not mistaken, took place at the end of last year. Did you have any hand with that?
No, I couldn't. No, I'm on a fixed income like most of guys my age nowadays, and we got to save our pennies.
Yeah, I'm curious. Did you hear anything of the results of it? I know I had even read something about it when it was about to happen, and the breadth that it was supposed to reach in its research. I'm curious if you heard any of the papers that came out of it or any of the thoughts that
yeah,
developed
again,
from
the
it.
Papers that came out of it would have been in Spanish, and then again, I would have had a heck of a time.
I
know you're Nelson. You're our go-to guy for Cuba here. You know the most out of all of us.
Well, I made some pretty good friends down there, and we saved a number of lives down there. The other thing we send lots down is multivitamins. 2 years ago, a year ago, 71 children in Cuba died of dengue fever. And there's not a heck of a lot you can do for dengue fever other than give them vitamins to help build up an immunity to help ward it off. So.
Wow, and you were able to get them down there. And did you? Was it set up as a recurring program, or was it something that you just were able to do once?
I do it constantly. I'm sending down vitamins all the time. As a matter of fact, I got to go to Costco next week and load up again.
Jeez,
and then I have one of my druggists here. She supplies me with. She sells me at a very inexpensive rate acetaminophen. I think I get 1,500 tablets for $14 or something like that. And we send them down as well. And as well, we also send stuff to the Grand Lodge for use in the Masonic home for the aged.
Wow. Wow. So they have the same programs in
they have a Masonic home. If you go to that website, freemasonry.org, you can read about their Masonic home. And it's very interesting.
I'm making a note here to do exactly that. Very interesting. I'm curious what the effects will be as the future moves forward. I know with Cuba just having the option to buy computers. If memory serves me well, in the media recently, talking about the new ability to actually be able to connect online being the biggest hurdle, but that computers are starting to become more prevalent. That there will be a wellspring of Cuban masonry online to
eventually,
a certain extent.
Because realize they only make $25 a month.
It strikes me as incredible the what that country's gone through and what they do.
The government supplies them with housing, right? Government supplies them with the basic essentials for food. And the $25 a month are for incidentals. And you gotta watch for a lousy $25 a month, you got to watch what you buy.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, but, it's like any situation. I'm sure that it's something that you can obviously get through. Everybody does, even as you mentioned just a moment ago, living on a fixed income or even just living in a budgeted household.
But you never
you're absolutely right.
But you never see a fat Cuban.
Probably to their betterment.
it should be noted, though, Greg, also that the Cubans are also well educated. A lot of them take up music, so they're all really good musicians. Not all of them, but I'm being a little broad stroked here. But their culture is just amazing, and so for the little bit of income they have, everything else is pretty much given to them. So you have to, it's a bit of a different philosophy than our North American, the way we survive, where we get all this money and we pay out a bit in taxes and spend the rest on everything else. They work and their government gives them a lot of what they need, and then their money
and what's interesting, it definitely comes back down to perspective. The American perspective obviously is different than the Canadian because of the relationships that are had between the two. It's having grown up here and read the media and paid attention to it, it's definitely different than having the ability, as you do in Canada, to travel down there and see it firsthand. It's a great thing.
When we travel down there, we seldom go into the cities, though, the towns and the cities, though. We usually just stay on the all-inclusive resorts and drink and party. There's a bit of a difference there.
Don't drink. What's that?
Patients don't drink. If you say that, United.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Put out in a lodge in the United States, and you'll get struck by lightning.
I almost did one day. That's another story. what I will say is that when Greg and I were talking, Greg, originally when I said, you know, I wanted to bring you on, Nelson, Greg was asking, well, how do you guys talk to Cuba? And I had to kind of tell him, well, from what I saw, Nelson gets emails from Cuba, and he's kind of surprised by that.
I get emails. One of the fellows that I do, I send stuff to, he has a daughter living here in Toronto, and she has to go back home every 11 months to get her papers done so she can stay in Canada, and that's where my cigars come from. Another fellow that I deal with, he gets mail out of Cuba is like, it's horrible. You know, you'll get your Christmas card in July or August if you're lucky. But his daughter works for a government agency that looks after tourists, so what he does is he gives her an envelope. They have Canadian stamps, and she gives this to a Canadian tourist who is coming back to either, you know, this part of the world, and they just drop it in the first mailbox, and I get my mail within like 2 days.
That's interesting. You know, again, it's a totally different perspective down here in America.
Yeah.
You know, one question that I wanted to kind of just touch on, because I know we're actually getting real close to the hour here. And this goes back a little bit to the Research Society, so even rewinding the tape a little bit, just one of the things that I want to cover real briefly, how do you see it as with, especially with the Phylaces, and then even as research lodges independently under their own grand lodges, how do you see them moving into the technological age? And I guess this could probably tie in with Cuba also as they come online with it, but do you see there becoming a wider discussion, even of topics like this, spreading across, you know, from websites, blogs, message boards, and any other medium?
Well, it's going to have to be. Like, well, the Phylaces Society has been on the web, I think, probably since, what was the name of the old network that we used to have? CompuServe.
I hear stories of that all the time.
Young whippersnapper. We've been on there since then. We have a CD-ROM with the first 50 years of the magazine on it. We will shortly, in the next year or two, be going to a second CD-ROM with the last 10 years on it. But this type of thing, I think, as our newer members, like I'm one of the old farts now, as our newer members come on who are much more technically inclined than I am, they're going to have no choice but to move forward into it.
Kind of take it by the horns and deal with it.
That's right.
Or it deals with you. I know it's a common discussion that we have on the internet and just in the blogs and really how to deal with these things as we move forward. You know, are we going to embrace it more? Or
the kids that are coming in today know much more than the people that are in the lodges on a large extent.
Absolutely.
Nelson, how much do you know about the start of Cuba Lodge? I was a little confused in some of my research. I saw in various sources, and you know, Grayson out of South Carolina was telling us about his lodge helping found Cuba, the Grand Lodge in Cuba. But then I also read about French influence in starting Grand. Do you know anything about that, or is that kind of out of your scope right now?
I know. I think it is the Grand Lodge of France has moved into the United States. But you got to realize that when you go down to Latin America, 99.9% of all the Grand Lodges are Scottish Rite Grand Lodges, which practices basically the same ritual as practiced in, I guess, four or five lodges in Louisiana, but done so in Spanish. I know that didn't answer your question.
Can I interject here?
Go right ahead.
Please.
Go ahead, Grayson.
Oh, based on my research, and again, I'm pretty much dumb sometimes, but I know that when the Grand Lodge of South Carolina chartered a lodge down there in Cuba, and it was for the sole purpose of creating a third lodge, so they could have three lodges to form a Grand Lodge, they had at previous times created two other lodges, but I don't know who those other. In addition to those two lodges, I don't know who else was down there. I don't know where they came from.
Well,
I just know that South Carolina created three lodges down there, And that last one was for the sole purpose of creating a Grand Lodge. That's pretty much all I know.
If you read Spanish, the Cuban Grand Lodge does have a website, and it lists all their lodges on there. But don't ask me what the URL is. You'll have to do a Google search for it.
Well, that gives us something to work towards. Now we can research if any of us can speak Spanish, and we can figure this out for another theme, because I do believe that Grayson's onto something, but I'd like to figure out how that impacts with France. So maybe if a reader can figure out the answer for us and email it into our mailbag. What's our contest, Greg?
The contest is if you send us an email and we read it on the air, you will receive one crisp new bumper sticker. Probably
awesome.
A couple. So send us your emails, everybody. Nelson, thank you for coming on. I know this is an interesting way for Dean to segue us out. So
I want to thank you guys once again, and you are to be commended on, you know, on taking this sort of step forward, and I think it's something that is needed in Freemasonry. And hey, listen, keep on doing the good job, guys. Keep on plugging.
Nelson, don't hang up on us, because after the show we have all the viewers have been listening to you. We have our little powwow after the show, which will end after I end the recording here, and this is where we have most of our fun, actually. So
the parking lot talk.
I'll grab a glass of Patron tequila.
Excellent. So again, thanks, Nelson, for being here. Thanks to all of our studio audience that was here. Just to hit some highlights of what's coming up next week, I think we're off, but stay tuned. There might be a change to that next week. So Dean, you and I can talk about that, because I think some things have changed in my schedule. So maybe there might be a special mystery guest next week. Or not. Maybe we'll just do another table talk. But then the 5th also, we have an open slot to fill, so keep tuned for that. But we do have some interesting shows coming up. We have Stephen Defoe coming up on the 12th. On the 19th, we have Jessica Harlan Jacobs, who's the author of, so I pull this slow website up, Builders of Empire, which is coming up also, which is a book that she's written. And that's coming up on the 19th. And then Tom Jackson on the 26th. And that's all of October. And then into November, we actually have a couple of special guests that I won't say anything just yet, because I haven't gotten confirmations from them yet. But one of them is from Scottish Rite Southern Jurisdiction here. Very interesting gentleman to talk to. And another is from another jurisdiction of Scottish Rite within the Southern Jurisdiction. If that makes any sense. That'll be two good shows. There's some good ones coming up. And then some others that are coming up also I don't want to announce yet. November is going to be an interesting month, though, and then we're rolling into December. And you guys can let me know what you think. I'm actually thinking that we might want to try to put together a virtual table lodge for December. So let us know what you all think. We have some time before it to figure it out. That might be something fun that we want to do.
It's going to be a BYOB party, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, sadly. But you know, for all of us that – do not, our lodges do not have table lodges, this might be a good way to celebrate it. So, anyways, those are the shows coming up. Dean, did you have anything to bring to the fore?
I had something. I never talked to you about this, but, you know, I there may be a chance in October where I might be missing for a show, and we'll need another person like me to kind of help you out.
Oh, you're irritating.
So I'm open for auditions and bribes, of course.
Irreplaceable, Dean.
To cover me while I'm away being a new dad sometime next month. So hopefully next month. Hopefully no earlier than next month. But I might need somebody, you know. I got a couple people on my short list here, but here's my first open invite for auditions for something, you know, you might be able to help us out with here and fill my shoes while Greg will take over the board for me, I guess. But someone to cover for me. So,
extra
so
pair
there's another little contest for you to write in to get your bumper stickers. And so two reasons to write in to get your bumper stickers.
There we go. So so if you're listening to us online, you can find more of these podcasts off of our website at MasonicCentral.com or iTunes. Just do a search for Masonic Space Central, and you'll find now all 11 of our episodes. So send us your emails, MasonicCentral@gmail.com, and let us know what you think. All right, Dean, you ready? This is
I'm ready. Do you think we're going to get it this time?
No. Let me say it again. This is Brother Greg Stewart and
Brother Dean saying...
Bang. Tr- Travel
Light.
Light. Hey, we got it.
Good.
Thanks, everybody.
That was great.